You are listening to Sparking Wholeness with Erin Carey, where we talk about all things related to nutrition for mind, body, and soul. Are you ready? Let's do this. Hey, everybody, it's Erin Carey. Welcome back to Sparking Wholeness. Today, I am so excited to introduce you to Dr. Mark Hauser. Dr. Hauser's scientific research, including over 300 published papers and 7 books, has focused on how the brain evolves, develops, and is altered by damage and neurodevelopmental disorders, with an emphasis on the processes of learning and decision-making, as well as the impact of traumatic experiences on development. His educational and consulting work has focused on the implementation of quantitative brain-based methods for teachers, clinicians, and doctors working with children who have different disabilities, including especially those that result from a history of traumatic experiences. His new book, Vulnerable Minds: The Harm of Trauma and the Hope of Resilience, offers a hopeful new pathway to understanding children's trauma and providing effective interventions to build healthier communities. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Erin. Looking forward to the conversation.
I am as well. And as I said before we started recording, I hate saying it, but I do love talking about trauma. I hate that we have to talk about it, but I also am always grateful for the opportunity to talk about it because it's important that we discuss this.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's always a difficult topic. I was just giving a presentation to a group of teachers and they were joyously laughing before the presentation, enjoying themselves. And I said, I hate to interrupt the party with this difficult topic, but here we are and it's important that we do it. So I think it's one of the things which is really grabbing a lot of people's attention, especially mm-hmm. today.
I'm so glad it is. And I am a former teacher. I started my career in middle school and with English as a second language students. So I saw students from coming over here from Mexico, from El Salvador, from Middle Eastern countries, from all over. And a lot of my students would not talk for a very long time, would not even try to learn the language. And other teachers would get so frustrated, like, they're being disrespectful. Why don't they just talk? Why can't they? And I didn't really understand trauma at that point. Now, I definitely suffered from PTSD at a very young age. And so I kind of knew what it was. But I thought, well, wait a minute, why are we trying to get these kids to engage when they're frozen, literally frozen in action? Yes. And so I think bringing that awareness is important in the classroom.
It really is. And I think teachers are, you know, maybe especially today, dealing with a lot of challenges themselves. And I think one of the things that I think has been really important, certainly in my work and many people's work, is letting teachers know that they often have children who have experienced various types of adversity that have led to certain kinds of traumatic responses in some cases, but they themselves may also be individuals who have experienced trauma. And sometimes the convergence of a child's trauma with a teacher's trauma makes for a very difficult situation because one is kind of affecting the other. And so those cycles need to be taken care of so that teachers can take care of themselves in order to help the children.
Gosh, that's a really good point. And I think that that's important to address. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. So when we are talking about somebody's trauma, why should we, and this sounds horrible, why should we care about the type of adversity they experienced? Because we all have stuff, right? We've all been through hard things. So why should we really care?
So I think one of the things that might help with this conversation, I think certainly it's something I try to focus on, is that the term trauma has become bandied about in a very colloquial, general way. And so that people who, I'll tell kind of an interesting story. An old friend of mine, one day I was walking downtown and I saw him and I said, you look really upset, what's going on? He goes, I'm just completely traumatized. I said, what happened? He goes, well, my son's soccer game got canceled. I'm like, okay. I said, small problem, maybe big response to the small problem. But I think that word has just become used so much now, in the same way that a lot of, clinical disabilities have become used in a colloquial way. Not to sort of pick up on one you said, or even make an interpretation, but PTSD, autism, a lot of clinical disabilities are now being used colloquially. Sadly, social media has become a platform where kids are self-diagnosing as bipolar, as anxious, and it's really caused a great deal of individual harm, sadly, but also made it very difficult in schools with parents because there's all the self-diagnosis, and so everything has gotten watered down. And so I think for me, one of the things that I focus in on the book is to have people be a little more clear and precise based on the science, because that's where I'm coming from, that adversity is one thing, that's the experience. And from that adversity, some people respond with a traumatic response, meaning something in the body and brain has been scarred by that adversity. Others respond more resiliently. They seem to manage and bounce back from the trauma. Traumatic response. So there's no traumatic response, even though the adversity has been similar to what other people may experience. So I think the reason why I also focus on different types of adversity is because they lead to what I call different traumatic signatures. So for example, neglect or deprivation of a child results in very, very different kind of physiological scarring than does abuse, and even different kinds of abuse. You mentioned as a teacher having children who come in where English is a second language. So they're immigrants coming into a country. So maybe they've left a home. Maybe they're refugees leaving very difficult situations. They don't speak the language. Maybe they're getting bullied. So there's a lot of adversity that they may be dealing with that's being brought into the classroom. So I think it's very important for teachers, parents, doctors, nurses, social workers, policymakers to be aware of what the sciences have uncovered in terms of these different kinds of signatures.
Yeah, I like that phrasing, trauma signatures, because I know, and again, to use my own life as an example, because I think that it is helpful sometimes to illustrate. But in my family, three of us experienced the same thing. Two were diagnosed with PTSD, one was not. So is that how different trauma signatures show up?
Yeah, so I think what you're pointing to with that example of the three sort of siblings is even within the same family, where there are obviously shared genetic backgrounds, because you're siblings, and assuming that, you know, not one of them was adopted, was that would take that biology out, but assuming you're biological sibs, then you've got shared genetics. In some ways, there was probably some shared experience, but because you're siblings of different ages, assuming you're not triplets,
two were
there's
twins.
Also different. So twins. Okay. So twins. So the twins, and this is important too, right? So, but at least one of you would have been either younger or older, and the timing really matters. And I'm sure this is a theme we'll come back to, but how old you were when you experienced the adversity can also have an impact on what shows up. And then in addition to that, even though you're all three within the same family, how each of you experience that family environment will also be different. So I have a brother, we're 2.5 years apart, but in many ways we're really, really different. Even though our parents were very loving to both of us, we ended up quite different. So I think that's important to realize, because part of resilience is the biology that each individual brings into the world with them. And part of it is the environmental aspects that can be both positive and or negative. And so that combination is going to tilt some people more towards the vulnerable end of the spectrum and others towards the more resilient end of the spectrum.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Before we get any further, because I've got lots more questions for you, I want to take a second and thank our sponsor for today's episode. This episode is brought to you by TrueMeta. TrueMeta is a premium supplement company based out of California that strives to make self-care easy. One of their great products is mushroom coffee. You guys, I've been loving this mushroom coffee. I've been adding it into my routine, and I definitely am experiencing some of the benefits that these delicious mushrooms bring. And yes, that's right. I said delicious because it doesn't taste like mushrooms to me. It tastes like coffee. This organic premium coffee blend contains lion's mane mushroom for productivity, reishi mushroom for immune support, cordyceps to boost energy, and of course, there is caffeine to give you the kick you need every day. I've loved adding this into my routine. My husband enjoys it as well. In fact, yesterday afternoon, I had some work that I needed to do and I needed to be especially focused. So I made myself some mushroom coffee with a little bit of coconut milk and a little bit of cinnamon. It was kind of like my, 1:30 p.m. latte. It was delicious and I got a ton of work done. Start your day or your afternoon healthier with Trumeta Mushroom Coffee and see for yourself how it helps you focus so you can get stuff done. You'll feel an uptake in your productivity every time you drink it. I know I do. Trumeta offers their best deal today only to my listeners. You will get a free electric mixer and 40% off the coffee plus free shipping in the U.S. So go right now to trumeta.com/spark to fuel your productivity and creativity with some delicious mushroom coffee. That's trumeta.com/spark. Now, Dr. Hauser, you mentioned that different types of adversity leads to different trauma signatures. And you're saying that it's a combination of biology plus the experience plus the age. I mean, there are a lot of different contributing factors that impacts how this shows up.
That's right. And so I think part of what I'm trying to do in part in the book is there's been this general sense that this child was traumatized. I mean, I hear this all the time in the schools. And by the way, often in very, very, very good schools. So I'm in Massachusetts, one of the states that has probably the highest level of education in the country. It's consistently a very strong state. And yet I continue to hear this is a child with trauma history. And yet what's not really discussed in any detail is when did that occur? What kind of adversity or kinds of adversity? Because some children will be multiple different types. Mm-hmm. For how long? How severe? How controlled? So there's all these different dimensions, which I think really ultimately sculpt that signature, whether it's traumatic or resilient.
Yeah, that's good. So just breaking down then the distinguish between adverse childhood experiences, I want you to talk about that because I don't think we talk about it enough, especially as far as, how it affects our health, trauma, and then resilience. How do we distinguish between those things?
Okay, good. So the adverse childhood experiences, the acronym being ACEs, really owes its recognition to Dr. Vincent Felitti. Felitti was a preventative medicine doctor. He's still alive and still very, very vibrant in San Diego. And the notion of an ACE, an adverse childhood experience, he and his colleague, Robert Anda, really put this on the map in 1998. The story is actually quite interesting of how they came to this. Dr. Felitti was running an obesity clinic at the time in San Diego, part of the kind of Kaiser Permanente hospital system. And it was a clinic where he had developed a method to take pretty much morbidly obese individuals and within a period of about a year, dramatically bring their weight down. And then because of the process, which is, of course, dramatic, he would monitor them often for several months to make sure they were okay. One day he had a patient who he was working with who had been brought down again tremendously, several hundred pounds. Her name was Patty. And he noticed in the monitoring process that she was beginning to gain weight back. And so one day he asked her, "So Patty, what's going on?" And Patty said, "Well, I know you may think I'm a little crazy, but I think I'm sleep eating." He goes, What do you mean? She goes, "Well, I live alone. I go to sleep, come back in the morning, and the kitchen has got pots and pans. There's food around. Clearly, I've been eating and I've been asleep." He goes, "Well, that's possible. Anything else going on?" She said, "Well, I'm having sexual relationships with an older man at work." "How do you feel about that?" Felitti asked. She says, Not very well. "Why not?" "Because when I was young, I was raped by my grandfather." Hmm. So what was striking to him, and of course, devastatingly sad, was that he had never asked that question to any of his patients. He had never asked them about their childhood experiences. So he then proceeded to ask all the people in the clinic about their childhood experiences, and about 80% of them said, "We had been sexually abused." He goes to a conference for doctors, this is important, they're medical people, on eating disorders. So they're all experts in various kinds of eating disorder issues. He presents his data and he's effectively laughed off the stage. They say, "Come on, look, these people are just trying to make up excuses for their weight. This is ridiculous." That night at dinner, he's sitting with a gentleman from the Center for Disease Control who says, "Look, I don't know if you're right or wrong, but if you're right, we've got a real problem on our hands. If something like sexual abuse in childhood can lead to these later life effects, this is not good." So Felitti, together with Robert Anda, produced this survey. Very simple. It said, between birth and the age of 18, did you or not experience one of the following 10 types of adverse childhood experiences, all within the family? So emotional neglect, physical neglect, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, and then aspects that happen in terms of family dysfunction, things like divorce or separation, mental health of a parent, incarceration, substance abuse. Okay. So there were 10 different types of adverse childhood experiences. People then said 1 if they had it, 0 if they didn't. You get a score, 0 to 10. At the same time as the survey was being handed out to about 17,000 people in Southern California, he was getting physical information about them because they were coming into a hospital. So physical issues, mental health issues, and so forth. To make a long story short, he publishes this work in 1998 that shows a very strong correlation between the number of ACEs and the significant health risks. This sent a shockwave through the medical community because what he was showing was that you get hundreds of percentage points higher risk if you have 4 or more ACEs. So the number of ACEs was predictive of risk of very significant healthcare issues, cancer, diabetes, morbidly obese, substance abuse, and so forth. Needless to say, the medical community started then trying to recreate this kind of evidence across the country and internationally. And lo and behold, this was not something particular about Southern California. It wasn't something that's particular about any part of the United States or even internationally. Basic result, ACEs are part of human existence, independent of race and religion and education and everything else. So that's the experience part. The reason why I mention that is because, unfortunately, I think people have interpreted that as trauma. But it's not. Yeah. It's simply the experience. And I'll come back to why that's important in a minute. Mm. Some people with those experiences have traumatic responses. Others do not. And that difference is critically important because it's by understanding both why some go the vulnerable route and some go the resilient that we are best able to help people. Okay. So that's kind of in a nutshell, the key idea. Experience is one thing, response is another, and within the response sense, there's a traumatic response, meaning issues of physical and mental health, and on the resilient side, it's that plasticity, that resilience to bounce back that allows some people to not be vulnerable to those experiences.
I am so glad that you mentioned that. I think that that is a really important way of looking at that. I mean, just I know I actually work out of a counseling center as a health coach, but with counselors. And I know that we look at ACEs. ACEs are important to go, okay, what do we have going on that just coming into a situation with somebody new, what do we bring into the table? You know, but those ACEs don't mean that that person has trauma responses happening, is what you're saying.
That's right. And I'll add one more thing because you mentioned it's kind of being used in your kind of environment. The one downside of the ACEs work to me is that it's begun to make its way into policy. So in California, it's being used as a screening tool for individuals for health insurance. And here's the problem. The ACEs questionnaire was never intended as a screener for individuals. It was designed as a population measure. So if you have an ACE score of 4, it is not predictive of your health risk.
Right.
And it's now been shown very, very carefully that the ACE score for the individual is not predictive of their health risks. And that's really important because what's happening is you're getting healthcare policy being wrapped around the score for individuals. There's no question that ACEs are in general a health risk. When you look at, for example, people who are incarcerated, life sentences, the odds of those individuals having high ACE scores is very, very high. Okay. So there's no question that childhood adversity can greatly impact future health. No doubt about it. But it can't be used as a screener. So that's the first point. The second one is keeping in mind that the initial ACE survey focused only on things within the family. So it did not consider things like community violence, war, poverty, discrimination, oppression, all those other things, which we know can greatly impact individuals, right? So it's limited in that sense. It never really thought about timing so that a child in utero who's developing with a mother who is stressed is going to have healthcare consequences later when it's born, she or she is born, because of the stress the mother is basically bringing to that developing fetus. And on the other end, it cuts off at 18, but we know that the big part of our frontal lobes continues to mature until about 23 to 25. So that was cut off. And yet that piece of our brain is continuing to develop. So 18, you cut it off. What happens after that is not considered. So you've got things that are happening before birth and things that are happening after 18 that were never included in the ACEs work. So those are just some of the pieces of why I want to urge caution. We certainly need to be aware of adverse childhood experience. Everybody should be aware of that literature. Hopefully this book will help do, but not as an individual screener.
That's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. I think that that is so, so important. Okay, so getting into your model of framework that you call the adverse T's, what are these T's that you mention? And can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So hopefully, I think letters often help us remember things. And so I give the analogy kind of a hand. So the first T is the type of adversity. And that's the kind of things that we had talked about. Different types of abuse, different types of family dysfunction, different, poverty, discrimination, oppression, and so forth. Then it's the timing. So when during development did these adversities or adversity occur? Do they happen early in life versus later in life? And we'll come back to that because we know that the earlier in life those adversities occur, the more damaging they're likely to be. Okay. So that's an important piece because that early development is so precious in terms of what's developing in the child. Third is the tenure, third T. So how long does it last? Some types of adversity may be very, very short-lived. Some may be chronic throughout that child's childhood. Again, that chronicity, long-lived adversity builds up often stress and changes to the physiology. And of course, it's cutting across different developmental periods if it's long-lived. Fourth is what I call toxicity, which is the severity of the type of adversity. And then lastly is what I call turbulence. That's kind of the unpredictability or controllability of the adversity. So for example, a child who is physically abused by a father who may be alcoholic, who comes home unpredictably and hits that child. That child has no control and it's completely unpredictable. Whereas the child living in sustained poverty, there's no control over it, but it's very predictable. Every day, I may not get enough food. Every day, I don't know where I'm going to sleep. These are horrors that many of the children that I work with in school are living through. It is a constant for them. And so those different dimensions, type, timing, tenure, toxicity, and turbulence, those are the adverse T's. By understanding how those different dimensions can impact the developing child, we are much more likely to be able to develop interventions to help them recover and build resilience.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned, can we touch a little bit more on the timing and the development of things and how that plays a role? Because I know something happens in the brain around age 7, right? And then there are all these different developmental shifts. So can you break that down and how that's important?
Yes. Yeah. And let me do that by illustrating with some examples. So we know that, for example, during the first couple of years of life, this is when there is what's often called kind of an exuberance of neural development and neural connections that are very much affected by experience. So one of the kind of concepts that I'd like to put on the table today in terms of timing is what are often called either critical or sensitive periods of development. These are windows of opportunity where if the right kinds of experience happen, then things will develop in a typical way. Typical meaning typical for the species. The notion of a critical or sensitive period is not something that's unique to our species. It's true of almost all species. There are these windows of opportunity where if the organism gets those experiences, they will develop species typical behavior. So for example, in the book, I do a lot of comparison between humans and non-human animals. And the reason for that is because a lot of the understanding of how things work at a mechanism level really comes from animal studies. Let me just give a simple example of a non-human animal study and then turn to humans. When birds and the fledglings are in the nest, they're in there and they're hearing the songs from their species, their father's song, because the males sing in most bird species. And that exposure to the song will enable that bird, when they begin to sing, often a year later, to produce the species typical song. But what's been done in some studies is you take a fledgling or nestling and you remove them from the nest so they don't get any exposure to their species typical song. And if that removal happens outside of their critical period, they will never develop species typical song. Okay, that tells you there's a critical window that if the experience doesn't happen, then they never get the species typical pieces. Okay. So one of the topics that I cover in the book, and this has some personal interest for me, is that our second daughter was adopted from Russia when she was 2 years old. And she was in an orphanage pretty much close to from birth. And it was an orphanage where, like many of the orphanages in Eastern Europe, she didn't have a lot of exposure to caretakers who were consistent and reliable. The food wasn't as nutritious as it might have been. She didn't really have clothes that she could call her own or books or toys. So there was very little stimulation coming into her life until we were able to bring her home and make her part of our family and enrich her in that way. So I'll just leave at that point. There was incredible work done out of Romania. And this was a very, very difficult time in Romania's history due to issues that Nicolae Ceaușescu, the then president, had imposed. Many thousands of children were put in orphanages that were extremely deprived of all the necessary ingredients. In the 1990s, three very distinguished developmental scientists, Charles Nelson, Charles Zena, and Nathan Fox, came in to begin to try to understand what had happened to these children and what might help them recover. This has now been almost a 40-year-long study because they've been following these children ever since to see what happens. And here's kind of a couple key take-home messages. Children who were in those orphanages up to the age of about 2, 2.5, who then were placed in foster care, largely recovered almost all social, emotional, cognitive, and physical developmental processes. If they were placed after that date, many of those disabilities maintain themselves. So there's this window of opportunity that if they were put into an environment where the experiential pieces came into play, many of those core functions would recover. That tells us there is this window. And there were different windows for different things, but it tells us these windows of opportunity, once they close, some things may never recover and some may be greatly delayed. And so what we see, for example, in many schools is children just like that, and where now the work is to try to build up that experience to make up for the delays that we see in a school environment.
Wow, that's incredible. It makes me so sad. I mean, that this is the part where I just get so sad when I think about all of that, because we think of how many people this affects. I also, it makes me wonder about the people who I remember. Okay, so let me see. My dad was born in the early 50s, and my grandma, I mean, she's passed many years ago, but she told me she was not allowed to pick him up and hold him when he was crying, because that wasn't done back then. They were told they need to self-soothe, right? So even for people, you know, maybe people who grew up here in the 50s, 60s, whenever that, maybe even now, there's a lot of sleep training happening. How does that impact development?
Yeah, great question. I think that raises a number of really interesting pieces that I spend quite a bit of time talking about in the book. I think one of the things I try to do in this book is be aware and sensitive to cultural differences in parenting, for example, or exposure to different kinds of things in the environment. So when we talk about, let's say, neglect or physical abuse, we are in some sense putting a definition on that, saying neglect is the absence of certain kinds of experience and physical abuse is a certain kind of physical harm. But cultures define those things in very different ways. So, for example, I do work in Kenya, a very, very different country, East Africa, right? Different culture, different norms, different moral systems, right? Than ours, let's say in the United States. So when you talk about neglect, we live in a very rich country. What we count as neglect is not necessarily what a Kenyan parent's going to consider to be neglect. In the same way that in Kenya, in many parts of Kenya, not all, slapping a child who misbehaves is perfectly normal. In the same way that within our country, there are 19 states where corporal punishment within schools is still legitimate. I don't live in that kind of state. I think, like, how could that be possible? We've learned that that doesn't do anything. And yet, in those states, if you said, do you physically abuse a child? Slapping a child in a school would not be considered as physical abuse. So it's really important to keep that lens on, because what counts in these cases, and therefore how you would answer that survey, is going to be wildly different across cultures. So what we do know, and this is why, to me, the focus on the traumatic response is often more insightful, is because how that child is responding is, in some sense, the child telling you this was traumatic. A child who is emotionally dysregulated, a child who is shut down, is telling you that the experiences they've had during childhood are not enabling them to have typical development, species typical development.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And then I do want to touch on one other thing. This is going back to something you said before, but my brain is holding on to it. The brain, you talked about the frontal lobe not being developed until the 20s. And so even things that happen from 18 to what, 25-ish, can still impact development. Can you share that? Because I know a lot of people, I know a lot of women too, who have experiences in college and abuse experiences, assault, things like that. And this impacts the way their brains develop at that point as well.
Yes. So well said. I think the issue here is, and I'll give an example. I think this is the most telling one, because we're all familiar with it. When we were living in the heart of COVID, everybody was socially deprived. Everybody, right? Some more than others. But, and going back to this critical period, the teenage years are a window where what is needed is social experience. It is like the acquisition of language that happens earlier in life. If you're not exposed to language input during the early years, you're going to show delays in language acquisition. For the teenagers, and I'm going to include my youngest daughter, who was 19, freshman year of college, COVID hits. She's home. She likes us. We did everything we could to be social, but we are not her people. Mm-hmm. And so she was socially deprived, and it hurt. It really hurt in that sense of hurt. And all the kids that I see in schools were socially deprived, and they are showing signs of immaturity in the social emotional sphere that is absolutely obvious. Everybody who's working in schools today sees this. I happen to work with children who are in special education, kind of high level special education for emotional disabilities. So they already are starting with difficulty. That social deprivation just amplified it a hundredfold. And so that really is an important thing for everybody to be aware of, is that that social need is there and social media doesn't do it for them. So my daughter was on FaceTime. She was on all these different it did not do it. That being with other people of your peers is critical. So that's one piece of, again, timing and how this really is important to that development. Let me bring in the brain piece because you mentioned it. That frontal circuitry, a really important part of what it does is it's involved in self-control. Mm. It's the brakes on what we do. The teenage years are both wonderfully and frighteningly a risk-taking period where they just try out all these stuff and they're willing to take risks that we old people are not willing to do. That is wonderful. It's the young people who are going to create new things. And that's the best part about it. But they're also going to take risks, and they're doing it at a time when the frontal area is still immature and not going to break it as much as it will later in life. So our emotional systems are developing very quickly and early, and our braking systems to regulate things are developing much later. When there's been traumatic responses that are going to cause delays in that frontal development, what you're delaying often is that self-control piece. And a lot of different kinds of adversity will lead to emotional dysregulation. And if that frontal lobe is immature, now you don't have something to tamp things down when you get frustrated, when you get angry, when you're out of control. So that's the real issue. And COVID just gave us a window on how providing children of that experience really hurt them in a traumatic way.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you touched on the COVID piece. That's fascinating. And it makes a lot of sense. One of my kids, he was a kinder baby when COVID hit. And so he's in fourth grade now. So those kids in fourth grade, I from what I've understood is that we're seeing a lot in those age groups because that early schooling was just interrupted for quite a while.
That's right. And I think, you know, again, so there you put your finger on a timing issue, right? So, a 4, 5, 6, 7 year old, right? That's the period where our whole social cognition world, our whole social thinking world is developing. So we're having this conversation. I know that, you know, you are interested in what I'm doing, and I think I understand that. And so I have these ways of thinking about your beliefs, my beliefs, and we understand that. Again, experience in that early period will cause delays in that social thinking skill, social communication, the pragmatics. And so those kids, that age group, was deprived of that kind of experience, which will then cause delays in that period of development. So these all things, they push in different ways. And I know that with a previous person you had on in terms of anxiety and so forth, again, these social experiences will also affect that because they're not able to develop these skills with their peers, right? Having us is not going to do the job. And so that's the deprivation they experience by a natural causing disease. But the consequences are now being felt in schools everywhere across the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. Now I want to talk a little bit more, since we have a little bit of time left, about your book. So tell me a little bit, what's the purpose of who is this book intended for, and what are you hoping to accomplish with the book?
Good. Thank you. The book's real audience is literally everybody. I mean, but I'm really thinking the book is divided really into three parts. The first part focuses on just what's typical development kind of look like? And what's the history behind the ACEs? And then this kind of new model or framework, the adverse T's. And then it's broken into first part, the most difficult part, is kind of the nature of harm. And this is kind of the harmful landscape. So we talk about neglect and deprivation and different kinds of abuse, and then war. And war, sadly, of course, now what's happening in Gaza and Ukraine, the book in war, it starts out actually with a case of a bombing in Gaza of Palestinians in 2021.
Wow.
Who would have thought? Here we are, and we're right back into the mess, right? So, and the idea there too is really to shine a broad cross-cultural lens, right? So we don't have a war in the United States. And who would have thought it would have happened in Europe? Who would have thought, you know, maybe in the Middle East? Yes, because it's a volatile area. But these are children experiencing very different kinds of adversity. So that's part two. Part three is the hopeful part. How can we build resilience and enable recovery? And so the hope of the book is really targeted at victims of different kinds of adversity, parents having children who've experienced different kinds of adversity, doctors who are often very involved, whether it's psychiatrists or pediatricians who are trying to help children either with medication, nutrition, or whatever their job is as a doctor, teachers who are often a critical lens on what's going on in the environment. As you may know, during COVID, for example, many parts of the United States for Department of Child and Family Services, there was a decrease of about 50% of reporting of neglect and abuse, not because it wasn't happening, but because teachers weren't seeing it.
Right.
So teachers are key, and they need to be equipped with tools to help children to be aware of what's going on. Looping back to our first part, teachers are often individuals who often have experienced trauma. So they need to be trauma-informed so they can build up resilience and take care of themselves. They will often be re-traumatized by certain children. So they need to develop protective skills to guard themselves as well. Policymakers, so we don't make mistakes, for example, like using the ACEs survey as a screener for individuals. So I am really trying to a global population, not just the United States, not just the Western world, but internationally. I know from working in Kenya, there's a real hunger to know about this stuff. These ideas are not there. And so that is my hope, that it provides people both an understanding of what happens in traumatic responses to children and what we can do about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your experience just in this field is incredible and speaks for itself. And I'm so glad that we got to have this conversation. And I'm really excited for listeners to get your book. So can they pre-order that now? I know it's not out until the spring, right?
It's not out until March, but yes, pre-orders available on the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, and so forth. There will be an audio version of it. They can go to my author website, which is markdhauser.com, and they can see more details there. So March it will be available. I really tried my best to write it for a general audience so that the science is understandable and meaningful, and so that the practical suggestions are useful. Again, cross-culturally, because I think there's an awful lot of extremely good books on adults who've experienced childhood adversity, but there's very little on the children who are experiencing it now. And I think that lens is important. The WHO, the World Health Organization, estimates that 1 billion children are maltreated each year globally. Mm-hmm. That is an overwhelming number. But we have these kinds of children in our midst, in schools, in homes, in group homes, children who may have been adopted, foster care, and we can do much, much more to help them.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the way that you shared that, and your passion is evident, and I'm grateful for your work. So last question that I have to ask, the name of the show is Sparking Wholeness. So if you could give one piece of advice to spark someone toward wholeness, what would it be?
I think to be aware of ourselves and our response to things. I think we often lose that, especially in a world where we're bombarded with media, is to take time to listen to our bodies and our brains so that we are aware of what's going on. I think too often we lose sight of responses that are happening and we're unaware of them.
Yeah, totally agree with that. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. I am looking forward to, I can't wait to put this episode out there because I think you brought a lot of things to light that we have not discussed before. And so I appreciate that. And I appreciate your perspective.
Thank you, Erin. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
The tiniest spark leads to the biggest blaze. And I hope that today's episode sparks you on a journey to healing and wholeness. Thanks for listening to Sparking Wholeness. For more information on what I do and my coaching programs, or maybe just to reach out and say, hey, find me at sparkingwholeness.com or on Instagram at sparkingwholeness. Have a fabulous week.